As for the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him also, because he is your offspring.
You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers to help you preach the good news in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And this week we're focusing on two of the readings from the Revised Common Lectionary, Genesis 21, 8 to 21, and Matthew 10, 24 to 39. And helping us again in conversation is the Reverend Rachel Kromberger, Uniting Church Minister at Yarraville in Melbourne, Australia. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks, Fran. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you back, Rachel. So we're continuing our focus on the Genesis narrative this week, Rachel. Is this text in chapter 21 about Hagar and Ishmael, is this one that you would leap upon to preach or one you would avoid?
Oh, I would leap upon it, Fran.
Right. Why is that?
Because there is so much in this story that that we can connect with and relate to. Once you start reading about these characters and developing empathy for their experience, very quickly the emotions that they express are emotions that we recognise and that our congregations will recognise.
And I think at the bigger picture level too, this is a remarkably gracious and abundant picture of God.
Absolutely.
Utterly merciful and, that level it's
And so soon profound. In Genesis after Abraham's been called to be the father of a great nation that will be a blessing to the nations, God's vision for humanity is already expanding beyond that nation.
So that might need some explanation. Let's get into the text. I think firstly, preachers might need to do a little bit of background on Hagar because we've met her in chapter 16 and, of course, the lectionary has skipped several chapters here. In 16 she's introduced explicitly as an Egyptian slave for Sarah, particularly a handmaid for Sarah. And there's a story there which is her first flight into the wilderness. In that story, she is pregnant and starting to receive hostility and mistreatment from Sarah. Mm-hmm. And so she flees. Mm-hmm. She flees the oppression and the exploitation she's facing. And, of course, because she's been a concubine, she's been tasked with bearing this offspring to fulfill the promise. And it's a remarkable story, which I just want to mention because I think it highlights the importance of Hagar in the biblical tradition. She there encounters a God who sees her and who saves her, and she names God El Roy, which is a play on words, God, the God who sees or the God who's seen me. Mm. She's the only person in the entire biblical tradition to name God. It's astonishing.
Wow.
And to see God and live, which again in the biblical tradition, no one can look on the face of God and live. So she has this profoundly intimate encounter with God. Now, it's not perfect. I know you said we have a liberating God here, but in that story, God sends her back potentially into an abusive situation. Mm-hmm. There's a grander plan at play. Mm-hmm. But feminists have struggled with how we interpret that story. But we meet her here again now having birthed a child some years later. And this time she is being pushed out rather than fleeing herself.
That's right. So Abraham, who thought that he couldn't see how God would fulfill God's plan to make a great nation of his household, now has two sons. Mm. He has Ishmael, who's of an unknown age, somewhere between 10 and 15 perhaps, and an infant now, Isaac, the fulfillment of the promise of God's covenant. Mm. And so so things are getting messy in the household as the family tries to discern what's happening next and tries to interpret how God's covenant is going to play out in their family life.
Yeah, and what it means for these children. And chapter 21, it's not in our lectionary, but it begins with the Lord singled out Sarah. So there's the priority of Sarah as the mother of Isaac, and that story begins there. Our reading will end with God watching over, God being present with the boy Ishmael. So that movement one of you just mentioned, I can't remember, I think, Rachel, you said about God's expansive vision. You know, it's a specific covenant, but it's already opening out here. Mm. We get that just in this chapter between the particularity of choosing Sarah to God's present being with the son of a slave woman who's Egyptian, who will father a whole other nation, mm, tradition and religious tradition.
I think it's worth saying that even in the context of these Genesis stories, we might look from our modern perspective on these stories and moralize about, well, of course, you know, Abraham was causing trouble for himself, sleeping with Hagar and having a baby with her, and, you know, and
what did he expect?
What did he expect to happen? But it's only in among his grandchildren that we have the situation where Rachel and Leah enlist their handmaids to birth sons on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And between the four women, they produce the 12 sons of Israel. And so it's not just this situation that on face value that's the issue. There's a lot more going on here in this particular household.
Yeah, and use of concubines would not have been unusual or had some of the resonances of perhaps unethical, you know, eyebrow raising that they would have in our current world. So it's not so much that he's, in fact, this was probably just a harsh and horrible reality. If you're a female slave in the ancient world, you may well just simply be used.
That's right.
As a child bearer for the patriarchal
and of course
family.
That practice went on way into the Western culture, where it was just taken for granted that kings would have mistresses.
Well, certainly in Henry VIII's court, well, it was right.
And even in the biblical tradition, King David, King Solomon, I mean, they've all got
dozens of them.
It's how you prove your kingliness or something.
So yeah. I think if we go into just these first couple of verses, we see some of the power plays that you've alluded to, Rachel. The child grew, yes, but Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian. So Hagar appears here as other, very other,
mm-hmm,
and retrospectively, of course, but named as an Egyptian because they're the oppressors of Israel.
We see that use of language in Kings, Uriah the Hittite. You know, that like it's very when someone's otherness is significant in the story, we get that very clearly.
And I mean, we do that exact same dynamic today, right? When we put an adjective before someone, a black person, an Asian American, or whatever it is, it can very quickly become not simply a descriptor, but a way to other, to signify they are different to ourselves.
Is she called Egyptian in chapter 16?
She is. She is introduced as an Egyptian slave.
Yeah.
But here again, there's a little bit of distancing beginning, which will continue with, you know, the son of Hagar the Egyptian, not the woman in our family that we asked to bear our child for us.
Yeah. Or even naming Ishmael in this particular sentence.
Yes, Ishmael doesn't get named all through this particular narrative.
But I do want to draw you on the word playing with her son Isaac, Robin.
Yeah, in verse 9, so the problem seems to start not so much when Ishmael is born, but when Sarah observes, and the way it's phrased in verse 9 is the two sons together and Ishmael is playing or laughing, depending on your translation. And it's a play on the word Isaac, because Isaac name means to laugh, mm-hmm, or laughter or something like that. Some of the commentators on this point out that the problem here is that Ishmael is behaving like Isaac. Ishmael is Isaacing. Mm-hmm. He is taking the place of Isaac. So whatever that means, even if it's a symbolic way of, this is the moment that something clicks in Sarah's brain and says, this child is not going to, and she says it quite specifically, a slave girl's son shall not inherit with my son.
There's a danger of a usurper suddenly.
A threat to her child.
And it's interesting because it happens when Isaac's weaned, not when he's born. Mm. It happens when she sees the two children together. She has a sudden insight about what's at stake for her family here.
Yeah. And she makes Abraham do the dirty work. So again, her othering happens at many levels. She starts talking about the slave girl's son. She stops even using Hagar's name, tells Abraham to send him away. And the text is unequivocal that this is an evil in Abraham's eyes. He knows this is wrong.
She made me do it.
Yes. Hello, Adam and Eve. yes. But God kind of goes, no, it's okay. Gives him permission, which is not unproblematic, but there's a greater promise and a larger picture going on here. The other thing I'll say before I shut up for a moment is in verse 14, there is an eerie little line we miss when Abraham sends her away, and Abraham rose early in the morning. We will get the exact same line in the next chapter where Abraham rose early in the morning and put his son Isaac for that story of the sacrifice of Isaac. So we get an echo here of two sons being sent out to dangerous places.
Mm-hmm. And Abraham, although he's not asked to sacrifice or to be the agent of death with Ishmael, he expects Ishmael to die here. So these are two consecutive stories in which Abraham rises early in the morning, having gone from being childless to having two sons. We have two consecutive stories now where he rises early in the morning and risks, at the very least, the lives of his
sons.
Two sons.
Mm. Yes.
It's awful.
With divine permission, if not divine mandate in both cases. Mm. This is such a moving story. They go into the desert and clearly the water runs out. And, you know, Hagar, if you didn't identify with her before, I'm sure anyone with a child would now, where they're basically out of water in a hot desert place and she cannot bear the thought of watching her son die. So she places him at a distance, a bow shot away.
Under the shade of a bush.
Yes.
That's all there is to
That's all she can protect him. Yeah. Yeah. She tries her best to protect him and then is basically weeping and crying out to God. But, you know, part of her cry is, I can't watch my son die. Mm. Don't make me watch my son die.
And interestingly, God doesn't, as the narrative says, God responds to the cry of the boy, not to her cry, which is interesting.
Well, I think, you know, she's a bow shot away. So maybe she's distanced herself to a place where she can't hear the child crying, which is, you know, if this is how she's feeling, it may well be what she's done. But God is faithfully present to the child.
Mm. Yes.
And God hears. She can't bear to hear, but God can hear and does.
Yeah. And as a narrative move, it helps explain Ishmael's name, which is God hears.
Yes.
Or God is hearing me. So, the fact that she cries out, but we're told God hears the boy, at first seems really jarring, but it's a way of saying that God's heard the cry of this lad and his name makes sense.
Which has profound implications for our understanding of interfaith relationships. Just to leap to the sort of bigger picture around how you might tackle this text in a sermon, this Ishmael is the father of Muslims.
Yeah.
And we're intimately connected in this one man, Abraham, and in this story. And I'm not sure how much that's explicitly understood or appreciated when we start to other each other.
Particularly in Australia, where people of Islamic faith are in a minority in Australia and are frequently scapegoated for various political ends and are easy for Anglo-Australians in particular to point to as being other. And here we find that we're actually, you know, we're cousins.
Yeah, and that election, God's election doesn't entitle you to all of God's attention at all, that God's mercy is much wider and that election means that God's care is beyond, you know, just you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Much the wider elect mercy. Group don't have exclusive claim to God's attention and love.
Yeah, it's a bit, you know, sometimes you hear parents saying to their children that you are the most loved and you are the most loved and you are the most loved. That's that sort of feel about it.
You're all my favourite.
That the Lord singled out Sarah and the Lord
watched over
Hagar. You know, this is...
And the boy.
And heard the boy.
And heard the boy.
And was with the boy, was present with the boy. So I think you could do a lot with that.
I think you could. And I mean, that raises a danger for me in preaching this text. So while I totally agree with your yes, Rachel, I mean, I'll actually be preaching on this text in one of the rare Sundays I preach now. It's way easier to talk about preaching than doing it. but it is so rich and it's such a wonderful text, but it does have potential pitfalls.
It does.
And if we just try and if we enter some of the rhetoric of the text and let it
dictate as if it
then we end up in the same conflict of two women, two children, two religions in conflict, and we fail to see the hand of God in both of their lives and both of their callings that put us in the same family, not at odds with each other.
Well, that's where I think looking at the text, not anthropologically but theologically, helps us out. Because if you look at what God's doing, not just at what the human actors are doing, you, I think, do avoid those pitfalls much more readily.
Yes, but hopefully.
Yeah.
And God is incredibly gracious through this whole story. God's gracious to Abraham and Sarah, saying, you've done a terrible thing here, but I'll look after them. God's gracious to Hagar and to Ishmael. And I think that openness of God's heart that we see here is something that has to be a lens for us as we try to apply some of this learning in our preaching and in our congregations.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I think I see in the text a tension that points to a discomfort even the ancient world with the treatment of Hagar.
Yeah, absolutely. So
if we think of these Old Testament texts that we have as really telling the story from the point of view of Israel, I mean, this is Israel's story, and it's kind of surprising to me that in a story told by the nation there are these ripples of the other story, that we have these moments of God showing favour and grace and love and protection towards the people, particularly Egyptians, who would become the enemies in the story of Israel. So there is – that to me says that even for the ancient authors, there is a discomfort perhaps around some of the justice and the inequality and the racist, the ethnic othering that goes on here.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And even in Israel's version of events,
yes,
there is an incredible sympathy for Hagar's plight.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for the way she's treated.
And the author or the authors that put this text together, they've set it up in such a way just structurally that Hagar's plight and anguish actually best parallels Abraham's. So while I know last week I said, you could perhaps, preach a sermon telling things from Sarah's point of view and Hagar's, and that's because we so rarely get women's voices. But actually the parallel is Abraham as the father of Judaism and Hagar as the mother of Islam. Mm. And it's really unusual for an ancient religion to have such a prominent female figure. Abraham kind of gets a bit left out of Ishmael's story in a sense.
But yeah.
Should we move on to Matthew?
Yes, I think so.
Which again is
it's a difficult one.
If those of you listening can't sense our hesitancy, we are perhaps thinking you're brave if you want to preach Matthew, but go for it.
Well, reading this text, I was reminded of your excellent podcast through the Easter season on First Peter and that exploration of a community of faith at odds with family members and community members and really experiencing the disconnect between a Christian worldview and and the ancient Greco-Roman worldview. And I think this gospel reading tells a lot of similar stories about for people who are isolated in their families or communities because of their Christian faith. And here in Australia, we're part of a wider Asian church in which actually most Christians in Asia practice a minority faith, and this is real life for them.
This is a reality for lots of Christians that aren't in Western countries. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I'm reminded just in the Beatitudes, if we want to connect this to the wider Matthew narrative, blessed are those who suffer for righteousness' sake, or blessed are those who are persecuted. I think it's perhaps important because this is a difficult passage, but to tie it in with some of the stuff in the Sermon on the Mount might be a way of entering it.
Yep. As a continuation of that teaching. It does also, there are some echoes of the Genesis passage here. I mean, in between the hard words are it does start with don't be afraid. We get don't be afraid of them in 26. In verse 28, don't be afraid of people who can kill the body. I mean, so while there's threat there is also that don't be afraid refrain that God is with you in Matthew's gospel.
Those assurances we talked about last week in the so-called Great Commission, that God is all powerful and that God is with you are not alone,
I'll be with you always,
which is still consistent here.
Yes,
that's
absolutely
right. And in fact there's some in the image of the sparrows in verses 28 to 30, where again that's framed by "Don't be afraid." It begins and ends that little small pericope there, with the example of the sparrows. You know that God wouldn't let any sparrow fall. Mm. So of course God's paying attention to you. Bill Loader in his lectionary commentary talks about, you know, the promise here isn't that you escape suffering. For Matthew's idea of discipleship, being like Jesus will mean you'll encounter suffering for the gospel, for Christ, not generalized suffering, but a specific kind of First Peter suffering. Mm. So it's not that you'll escape that. That's not the comfort, but the comfort is that God knows and God is with you in it.
Which is what happened in Genesis, where God heard, "Do not be afraid," he says, "for God has heard the voice of the boy."
That's right. God is hearing, God is seeing.
Yeah. And that image of the sparrows, you know, I can remember Sunday school songs about the sparrows and the hairs on your head, and there's Bob Dylan and the Blind Boys of Alabama and all the music that
lots of musical suggestions.
You know, where these couple of tiny images have been a source of incredible comfort for people.
Yeah.
That reassurance that Hagar and Ishmael experienced in the wilderness, that God sees, God notices that suffering might be present, but so is God, and that we don't ever suffer alone.
Mm. I think Matthew, like, it's difficult, as we said, but Matthew's very realistic about the offense that the gospel provokes in the world by challenging the world's order of competition and violence and threat. And at the moment, you know, we're observing around the world, well, in the United States particularly, quite profound violence, and actually the president using a church and a Bible as a prop, which is quite...
While talking about the threat of military violence and using
that violence to clear the protesters so he could have that photo opportunity, I think I would see this passage as provoking me to preach it, sister, you know.
Yeah.
Preach the love, preach the compassion, preach the wounded love that is at the centre of the faith. And it does cause ire.
And it might not be popular.
That's why, no.
No, there's a slight comfort to me when you read the whole of chapter 10, which are basically kind of instructions to disciples about how to be apostles and do mission, is that it's not a grand success story. You're going to meet hostility. You won't always win. I mean, you know, there's a strange kind of comfort in that if you're leading a church congregation and, you know, it doesn't seem easy. Well, it was never promised to be easy. It wasn't easy for the people walking with Jesus at that time.
No, and as a comedy writer actually once wrote, a good preacher is never beloved.
Yes.
This is not what we're called to do to elicit the love of our congregations. Yes. We're called to preach the love of God.
Yeah, and this is one of those texts that if you really preach it, you might not get warm smiles at the end of your Sunday service saying thank you.
That was lovely.
That was lovely because it might not be lovely.
It shouldn't be, really.
And we should talk about the family stuff because that's definitely not lovely.
Yes. It's a tricky thing. You know, I've supported women in violent relationships at different times in my parish ministry, and I've supported women in situations where their partner thought it was safe to send them to church because the church would tell them to stay where they were and stay married, regardless of violence that was present. But I've also supported women whose partners thought that the church was a threat to their power, and that was extremely difficult and dangerous for them. And this is something that's happening statistically in all of our churches. So, you know, this is something that that might need to be aware of. And in this time of social restrictions with the COVID-19, there are strong suggestions that tension in families is escalating as a result of people being locked in together. So when we talk, I mean, all the readings today talk about power in relationships, power between adults and between adults and children. And within families. And as we said last week, I think it's really important to remember that if you're live streaming or preaching to a YouTube video for your sermons this week and you don't know who's listening. Mm. And even if you do know who's listening, you might not know the detail of their experience. I would really urge you to draft and edit and draft and edit and really pray for sensitivity and empathy for any unknown situations into which your words might be going this week.
And that's great advice. As soon as we're touching on, which so many biblical texts do, anything to do with power and gender and family and abuse, I mean, it's those stories are there throughout the biblical tradition, and we can't be glib or careless in the way we, address them.
This is not permission to
carry on. Yes. So even though there's a violent image here, right, with Jesus saying, I came to bring a sword, not peace. So it's an uncomfortable image for us.
And apparently contradictory to most, to the, you know, how we've been taught to understand Jesus coming.
Yes.
Although there are others. Yes. But even popularly.
Yeah. And Jesus Matthew does have Jesus as a judge. And there are several moments, you know, we'll get to, what is it, chapter 25 with the sheep and the goats. There is a sense that Jesus comes to sort things out and you need to be alert and careful in Matthew. But here I think, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree with everything you just said, Rachel, but I think here that the dynamic is not even where there's a problematic or abusive relationship. There's a threat to even the most harmonious and, you know, kind family, potentially. In Christian terms, we've equated the nuclear family often with what equals a Christian family, which is its own problem. But that actually your allegiance is to God, and that might call you to be at odds with your family. That might create a rift.
So the family values rhetoric that's applied to, well, purported to be Christian values.
He's not supported by the biblical text.
And I think it's... Yeah, that something must be said about that if I can go so far.
And that the values that our faith in Christ calls us to hold can be completely contradictory to the values that sustain relationships in some families, and that we need to critique our family lives as much as we critique all our behaviour in response to the gospel.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, there's no part of our lives that doesn't penetrate and cause us to examine, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, any last words for preaching on this third Sunday after Pentecost? Hopefully we've given everyone lots of different ideas. I mean, you could talk about everything from family through to, I think a theme throughout has been this power, the way we other other people or use power over.
I would only say that I'm sure you preachers do this every Sunday, but really begin your preparation this week, I think, with praying for your people.
Well, thank you, Rachel. I think we've ploughed many of the depths of these readings this week.
Much appreciated having you here. Yeah,
really enjoyed
us.
It's been a joy to be here.
Thank you for listening. You've been listening to By the Well, a podcast made with the support of the Uniting Church in Australia and the Pilgrim Theological College.